Good evening and welcome to this library colloquia. It's my great pleasure. I'm Mary Black Juntinen, and I'm the music librarian, and it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Carol Hess, who is professor of musicology and ethnomusicology and also has an appointment in the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies. She comes to us from Bowling Green University in Ohio, and she acquired her PhD at the University of California, Davis. She has been a longtime expert and studier of Latin American and Spanish music, and has also written on such varied topics as Johannes Brahms, who is almost as far away in some ways as could be from the ethnomusicological and Spanish materials. She's been a reviewer for many different periodicals, and she has won numerous awards, including two Fulbright grants for study in Spain and in Latin America. She has three books in publication already, which I'm happy to say the library owns. She has a number of articles that you would find in our library collections as well. And we have she has a forthcoming book, which you can be sure we will purchase as soon as it's available. And if you have any idea, any questions, I'm sure she'll be glad to answer them. The topic for tonight has been changed. Some of you may have heard the announcement earlier. They said it was Villa-Lobos. It is actually Alberto Ginastera. And so without further ado, I give you Carol Hess. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And I'd also especially like to thank Professor Harlan Jennings of the Voice Area of the College of Music for initially inviting me to speak to you tonight, and for, I understand, organizing this whole series of library colloquia in music. I thought about several things that we might explore, and I decided that the Argentine composer Alberto Ginastera was a sure ticket. Again, I'm sorry if any of you came to hear about Villa-Lobos. I changed my mind on this in mid-February, and there were some flyers erroneously advertising Villa-Lobos, so now is your chance to leave in a huff if you wish to do that. You see, Professor Jennings initially asked if I might speak about American music, and lately I've been researching the concept of America in the broadest sense of the word. That is, using the term to refer not just to the United States, as is often done, but to embrace North, South, and Central America, which some scholars call Greater America. I decided that Ginastera's career showed several ways in which we in the United States have perceived Latin American music over the years. Not only that, but one of his pieces was featured last fall in a concert by the College of Music Symphony Orchestra, and in December, the U of M School of Music and Dance celebrated a week-long Viva Ginastera festival, so I thought the topic was also timely. Although one of the most important Latin American composers of the 20th century, Ginastera hasn't yet attracted that many scholars in this country. And so when I began working on my most recent book, which I'm glad the library is going to buy, I discovered that no one had really laid out the reception of his music in the United States. So today, I'll interweave highlights of that reception with important moments in U.S.-Latin American relations and mid-century musical trends. My motives are mainly historiographical, historiography being the writing of history, what sort of practices historians use when they decide, I'm going to write a history of X. They're directed at the question, what do we in the United States know about Latin American art music, and how do we know it? How have music scholars written about it? And why is it that when we read much scholarship from the past few decades, at least, we pretty much would arrive at the conclusion that Latin American music is nationalistic, with folk dances, folk songs, and little else? Take my word for it, if you look through much of the literature from this period, you find that many U.S. scholars indulge in descriptions of, quote, unmistakably Mexican or genuinely Peruvian musical works. This is an essentializing discourse through which unspecified but somehow unmistakable traits are attributed to a given country or region. Also noteworthy are Latin American art music's primitive qualities. That's something else that historians emphasize, which is presumably the legacy of the indigenous populations in Latin America. In describing things in this way, scholars effectively situate Latin American music on the periphery. That is, they set it apart from the universal music composed in the more important central countries, most of these being European countries, of course. And yet there was also that upstart nation which flexed its musical and political muscle throughout the 20th century, the United States of America. As it turns out, one person who has fundamentally shaped our understanding of Latin American music is awfully familiar to those of us in U.S. musical circles. Let's pretend it's the fall of 1941. Ginastera is 26 years old, and he's making his way as a composer in his native city of Buenos Aires. Whom do you suppose he meets there? Of course, this is Aaron Copland. Why is Copland in Buenos Aires in 1941? Well, he was sent to Latin America under the auspices of a State Department agency, the Office for the Coordination of Commercial and Cultural Relations between the American Republics. That mouthful of a government entity, it was later shortened to CIAA, was headed by an energetic young Nelson A. Rockefeller. Rockefeller was a Republican working in a Democratic administration. Imagine. It charged Copland with first performing music of the United States, lecturing on U.S. music, and last, identifying possible Latin American composers for exchange visits to the United States. All of these activities formed part of a broader vision, that of an American continent united against European fascism. Don't forget, World War II has broken out at this point. According to this vision, known as the Good Neighbor Policy, the United States would no longer exercise its military or commercial power south of the Rio Grande, and it would cease the sort of interventionism into Latin American governments that had taken place during the 19th century, but which had especially peaked during the teens and 20s, the early part of the 20th century. Instead, the U.S. would seek economic and political ties with that region, which some people called the Other America. And there's a political cartoon of President Franklin D. Roosevelt making friends in the Americas. The United States government would also seek effective ties, however, mainly through culture. And that's where the CIAA comes in. Rockefeller's organization had 59 committees, and it was generously funded. Of course, there were many congressional squabbles about the amount of money that was being spent on culture between North and South America. It sponsored projects in literature, education, the sciences, film, sometimes with admittedly dubious results. People of a certain age in the audience, or any of you who might be female impersonators, will recognize the Brazilian bombshell, as she was known. This is Carmen Miranda, whose fractured English and on-screen antics made her a favorite among the U.S. movie-going public, but far less popular in Brazil, which is where she grew up. Of course, music, both commercial and concert music, made its mark on the Good Neighbor Policy as well. We can guess, however, from the red, white, and blue cover art here on this piece of popular music, which of the Americas likely had the upper hand. Just as policymakers urged, quote, hemispheric cooperation and inter-American unity, Copland, acting on behalf of art music, sought to identify a musical voice peculiar to the Western Hemisphere. As a result, during the 1930s and 40s, Latin American music made itself felt in the United States to a degree unequaled before or since. But let's go to Buenos Aires, a city proudly dubbed the Paris of Latin America by any number of its cosmopolitan residents. While in the Argentine capital, under State Department auspices, Copland met all the main composers, many of whom readily acknowledged their European heritage. Of all the composers he met, Copland was most impressed by one named José María Castro, who was the oldest son of a musical dynasty and whose third piano sonata, as Copland confided to his diary, was, quote, the best piece I've heard in all of Latin America. And this is José María Castro is on the far right. These are some of the composers Copland met. Running a close second, however, was Ginastera, whom Copland hailed as, quote, the great white hope of Argentine music. We read as much in Copland's 1942 article for the magazine Modern Music, which he published just after he returned to the States and which was largely drawn from the diaries he kept during his South American trip. And this is a picture I took in the Library of Congress As you can see, Copeland's Latin American diaries are just a series of spiral notebooks, but they're very interesting to read. The article for Modern Music is surprisingly direct. Surprising, that is, when we consider Copeland's mission of cultural diplomacy and his widely accepted status as the affable face of musical Pan-Americanism. He pretty much dismisses Ginastera's more cosmopolitan compatriots. Among these was Juan Carlos Paz, who was Latin America's first serialist. Serialism was a very modern trend that was widely practiced in Europe. Here's a picture of Paz. And Paz's music was performed at international festivals, including one held in Ann Arbor in 1939 at a conference on Latin American music. As for Ginastera, Copeland was ever on the alert for what he called a Western Hemisphere music, one that could stand up to Europe. So therefore, in his article, he acknowledges Ginastera's susceptibility to Europe, noting, for example, Ginastera's, quote, natural flair for writing brilliantly effective, surefire music of the French-Spanish persuasion. A saving grace, however, was the increased charm acquired through a well-placed use of local melodic phraseology. In writing these words, Copeland may well have been thinking of Ginastera's most nationalistic work, the in-progress ballet Estancia. This tale of gaucho and ranch life on the vast Argentine pampas, familiar to us today in its version as a concert suite, is perhaps best known for its final malambo. This is Ginastera's stylized, testosterone-charged evocation of this gaucho dance, which often relies on alternations of 3-4 and 6-8. How do Copeland's initial reactions to Ginastera square with the Argentine composer's eventual status in the United States? Often when Copeland wrote about Latin American music, he was effectively echoing his own aesthetic, which, to be sure, changed more than once. In the 1940s, Copeland's aesthetic revolved around his desire to express himself, as he put it, in the simplest possible terms, that is, to counter what he perceived as a growing rift between art music composers and the musical public. As we all know, Copeland's populism often involved folklore, as in Billy the Kid or Appalachian Spring, works often seen, not surprisingly, in nationalist terms, that is, as quintessentially American, that is, of the United States. Yet in 1941, few composers who drew on folklore, whether in the United States or in Latin America, were particularly eager to consider themselves nationalists, since nationalism was then tainted by German chauvinism. Many Latin American composers, moreover, aspired to first-world cosmopolitanism and deliberately pursued anti-folkloric styles. These included Paz, the serialist I just mentioned, and a whole phalanx of neoclassicists, whether from Cuba, Mexico, Venezuela, or Brazil. As I'm sure you're aware, neoclassicism was a school of composition that flourished after World War I and drew on traditional models of sonata form, fugue, and modified tonality, all directed towards the goal of cosmopolitanism. Yet Copland adamantly prescribed folklore for Latin American composers. His praise for Ginastera's mastery of local melodic phraseology, just one example. In doing so, Copland reflected the values of the CIAA's Music Committee, of which he was also a member. Essentially, these five men defined Western Hemisphere music, and as you can see, the chair of the CIAA Music Committee was a librarian, and a very important one. They decided which projects to fund with their very generous budget. A tour of Latin America by the Goldman Band, a Christ of the Andes symphony by an unknown composer. And they also fielded suggestions from the musical citizenry at large. Author and pianist Arthur Lesser of the Cleveland Institute of Music wrote to Carlton Sprague Smith, the chair, apropos a plan to commission new Latin American works to be performed by various symphony orchestras in the United States. He gave Latin American composers the following advice. Do not interpret the commission as an opportunity to show off the extreme limits of your imaginative horizons. South American rhythms are swell, and Indian percussion instruments are fine, provided they are not too hard for our boys to learn how to play. But webs of atonal dissonant counterpoint are definitely out. Nothing remotely resembling Hindemith, Schoenberg, Post-Sacre Stravinsky, or Bartok will do. Here I am not speaking as myself, but as a representative citizen of a fairly progressive Middle Western large city. Lesser also urged composers to celebrate their Latin American identity. The titles of the compositions are important. Variations on an original theme is not particularly calculated to arouse an interest in South America. But a title like Anaconda or Comodoro Rivadavia is intriguing and will start a burgeoning of program notes with consequent fixation of attention. If many of my students wrote that sentence, they'd be... In short, any Latin American art music that would be applauded in the United States had to sound Latin American, either folkloric or primitive, as the label Anaconda would suggest, and appeal to a broad public. To be sure, such accessible music might veer precariously close to the values of the culture industry, that is, Hollywood and popular culture that critics such as Theodore Adorno so vehemently attacked. This proximity to the culture industry manifested itself, some argued, in works by U.S. composers that evoke Latin America, such as George Gershwin's Cuban Overture or Copland's El Salón México, which was used in the 1947 MGM film Fiesta. Given this backstory, we might be surprised to learn that Ginastera's Latin-sounding works didn't fare all that well in the United States during the Good Neighbor period. In 1941, the New York press largely overlooked a broadcast of his indigenous ballet, Panambi, with the NBC Symphony. Another on-air performance of that work by Eric Kleiber 5 years later also went unremarked. In 1946, when Ginastera visited the United States as a Guggenheim Fellow, he had the pleasure of hearing another of his malambos, this one for solo piano in Carnegie Hall. By suggesting that it was, quote, based on the rhythm of a primitive dance, rather than the rural genre it actually evokes, New York Times critic Olin Downs situated Ginastera's malambo into one of the more familiar discourses in Latin American music. The five Argentine folk songs were likewise equated with, quote, simpler and more primitive expression. During the 1940s, a handful of singers programmed the wistful Canción al Árbol del Olvido, the Song to the Tree of Forgetfulness, an early work of Ginastera's, which is Opus 2. Thank you. Thus, during the golden age of Pan-Americanism, that is, during the war, Hinostero's folkloric nationalism attracted relatively little notice, at least in the musical capital of the United States, which I am, as a former New Yorker, claiming New York to be, but I realize there could be disagreement on that point. In contrast to this critical silence was the enthusiastic reaction to a concert sponsored by the League of Composers, also based in New York, in February 1947. Although neither Downs nor his counterpart at the New York Herald Tribune, Virgil Thompson, were convinced by Hinostera's Pampayana No. 1, which is for violin and piano, or by the five Argentine folk songs, both of these critics enthused over Hinostera's markedly non-folkloric duo for flute and oboe. Downs praised it as, quote, felicitously written, very objective and formal, purely linear, in no sense nationalistic. Thompson, too, approved of these qualities, despite, perhaps even because of, the lack of regional signifiers in the work. He proposed, quote, this is the kind of music that makes one believe in the New World. And sure enough, by the 1950s and 60s, the local melodic phraseology and rich folklore of Latin America that Copland had extolled in 1941 were dealt a death blow. As you probably know, during the Cold War, composers tended to pursue objectivity and abstraction, with many trying their hand at serialism or experimental music. This phenomenon, which coincided with the rise of U.S. power in the post-war period and with various shifts in international alliances, affected cultural diplomacy, which now had to reckon with new music, new allies, as musicologist Amy Beale puts it. At the heart of the Cold War in Latin America was Washington's anxious vigilance. Now that World War II was over, the hemisphere was no longer united against a common enemy. The central question became, would Latin America embrace U.S.-style democracy or communism? To ensure the former, the United States returned to interventionism, often in tandem with business interests or the newly created CIA. Regrettably, it supported many a military junta, a turn of events Senator J. William Fulbright lamented in his 1966 book, The Arrogance of Power. Certain buzzwords reflected this new orientation in U.S.-Latin American relations. One, for example, was progress, most conspicuously showcased in President John F. Kennedy's Alliance for Progress, a set of government programs that promised economic stability in Latin America as a means to resist communism. Progress was tied to the so-called modernization theory. Widely accepted in academic circles, the theory held that if Latin America would only modernize through economic growth, problems of resource distribution would disappear and dictatorships would be less likely to take hold. In fact, the opposite turned out to be true. Another buzzword was nationalism. Once associated with Nazi cultural objectives, nationalism was now equated with both communism and anti-U.S. sentiment, at least when it came to Latin America. In 1952, journalist Herbert L. Matthews wrote that the sort of nationalism taking root in Latin America was, quote, a destructive and above all anti-Yankee force. In a 1953 speech at the Pan-American Union, President Eisenhower proposed that those American nations that had overcome, quote, the temptations of heedless nationalism were the least vulnerable to forces threatening this continent, that is the Soviets, of course. Covering Vice President Nixon's disastrous tour of Latin America in May 1958, a reporter for the New York Times reported on a mob, quote, incited by communist agitators, evidence of a supercharged atmosphere of extreme nationalism, end quote. Standing up to these communist hordes was the individual, another buzzword, who embodied the benefits of liberal society, such as freedom of inquiry and expression, both nurtured by scientific objectivity. These terms also permeated aesthetic discourse. Musicologist David C. Paul notes that music historians of the era emphasized freedom and the individual, as in Henry and Sidney Cowell's 1955 biography of Charles Ives, for example, in which Ives is no longer considered an eccentric ethnographer, but, quote, an autonomous man representing the United States itself, a bastion of autonomy, free of ideology. The Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was a CIA-backed concatenation of offices, publications, and cultural agendas, also promoted an anti-communist agenda. As for composers, many took scientific objectivity, unencumbered, of course, by ideology, as their aesthetic ideal. Like research scientists, they engaged in the presumably neutral investigation of tones, rhythms, and mathematical relationships. In creating aesthetic, often serialist works, composers were also sheltered from the mass public, with its limited capacity for intellectual engagement, instead responding to an elite. And I just want to make sure that it's understood that this is not necessarily my opinion. This was the opinion of people who practiced these kinds of compositional practices, some of whom wrote about it quite vociferously. To be sure, some critics detected hypocrisy in this outlook. Reporting on a 1952 event sponsored by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the British music critic Colin Mason observed that Western artists seemed unconcerned with actual human freedom. In other words, they cared only that their communist brethren were free to be cubists, surrealists, dodecaphonists, or existentialists. Musicologist Anne C. Schreffler notes another paradox. Although the abstruse rules of serialism of Cold War-era music ostensibly privileged freedom, composers willingly submitted to the strictures it imposed. Additionally, she notes, artists were hardly free to be landscape painters or tonal symphonists. Neither, we can add, were they free to be Latin American musical nationalists. All these developments affected composers in Latin America. In 1944, the Uruguayan musicologist Francisco Kurt Lange dismissed folkloric nationalism as reactionary. Now, however, it could stand for socialism or even communism. Chilean composer Juan Orrego Salas, for example, noted that composers working with folk music were, quote, limited by their self-imposed nationalistic aims and thus captive to an ideology that, to a certain extent, fit into the patterns of social realism promoted by the communists, end quote. Accordingly, Latin American composers embraced serialism, aleatory, and electronic music. Extending past his solitary efforts of the 1930s, Hans Joachim Kalkreuter in Brazil, Roberto Falabella in Cuba, and Jorge González Ávila in Mexico, along with their students, all took up serialism. The first electronic studio, the Estudio de Fonología, was established in 1958 in Buenos Aires. Other Latin American composers, however, complained of what they considered a double standard, one that essentially implied good and bad nationalism. Aurelio de la Vega, who left his native Cuba in 1959 for the United States, for example, complained of, quote, United States music critics accepting with applause the nationalism of Copeland's Billy the Kid, gunshots and all, while sneering at the maracas and drums gestures they themselves had attached as a label to every Latin American concert music piece. Copeland himself made an abrupt about-face in his assessment of Latin American music. In late 1954, the once staunch advocate of folklore complained apropos the first Caracas Festival of Latin American Music that, quote, the program planners seemed to overemphasize the folklore-inspired side of Latin American music, flatly concluding of dodecaphonic serial music there was not a trace. Of course, by then, Copeland had completed his piano quartet, an early experiment in serialism. He had also reflected on the 1948 Prague Declaration by Eastern Bloc composers, which prompted him to link 12-tone composition, serial composition, to, quote, writing against militant communist opposition. So where did all this leave Gina Serra in the 1950s? It wasn't his mastery of local melodic phraseology that established him in the United States. Rather, his works that most closely responded to the horizon of expectation that I've just outlined, to the musical priorities of the Cold War, these were the works that did the trick. Aiding his ascent was musicologist, radio host, and cultural diplomat Gilbert Chase. Here are just two of Chase's books. Chase was acquainted with the Spanish composer Manuel de Falla, dedicated a chapter to Falla in the Music of Spain, and his perhaps best-known book, America's Music, went through three editions, and it's still used in universities and colleges, and as you can see, you can get it on Amazon. Since the 40s, Chase had mistrusted what he called folkloric nationalism, although he allowed that this form of creative expression permitted some, quote, musically backward or retarded nations to achieve self-confident expression, end quote. Elsewhere, Chase elaborated on folkloric nationalism in relation to Latin American musical progress, identifying provincialism, nationalism, and universalism as three stages of development. Although, to be sure, he added, only a few countries had attained the third. Progress eventually moves provincialism, Chase concluded. Yet Chase argued that, quote, the preservation of national character is essential to the achievement of true universality, end quote. Chase also privileged the universal, the individual, charged with employing technical acumen, modernization, to channel nationalist impulses toward a higher state, toward progress. In fact, Chase's blueprint for Latin American musical progress runs loosely parallel to the tripartite division of Ginastera's works that scholars have traditionally taken as a point of reference. That scheme has informed Ginastera criticism ever since the 1960s, when the composer offered his principal biographer, Paula Suarez Urtube, the following account of his evolution. It embraces objective nationalism, subjective nationalism, and neo-expressionism. In 2001, 18 years after the composer's death, Deborah Schwartz-Cates, another Ginastera scholar, recognized that this model neglected almost 20 years of the composer's life and appropriately proposed a fourth period, which she calls final synthesis. She and others caution that the style periods are far from rigid. But we can make certain generalizations. In the objective nationalist works, for example, we are likeliest to hear the local melodic phraseology that Copland praised, whether in the form of the gaucho-centered malambo that we've just heard, or in Argentine vocal genres such as the triste. The triste is a lament. It's often heavily ornamented, and it's associated with the life of the gauchos and the life on the pampas, the vast plains in Argentina. We might also hear in the objective nationalist works Ginastera's so-called guitar chord. This is his evocation of the open strings of the guitar, which, as I say, figures conspicuously in several of these early works. As we've just seen, this music was greeted less than enthusiastically in the United States in the 1940s. Well, come to find out, the same can be said for many of Ginastera's subjective nationalist works, which treat Argentine folklore less explicitly, and which were composed in the late 40s and early 50s, and then performed in the United States shortly thereafter. One such piece was Pampeana No. 1, which had compared so unfavorably with the objective and anti-nationalist duo, the work that we just heard. Ginastera's orchestral music fared even worse. Reactions in New York to Pampeana No. 3, he wrote three Pampeanas, one for violin and piano, one for cello and piano, and Pampeana No. 3 is for full orchestra. And the reactions in New York to this work ranged from lukewarm to hostile. Harold C. Schoenberg of the New York Times, for example, tagged it as a, quote, gorgeously orchestrated hunk of nothing. In October 1955, Harold Taubman and Paul Henry Lang took swipes at the Variaciones Concertantes. Now, this was the work that the MSU Symphony performed in October. The theme features the guitar chord, but it's not set up in such an obvious way as in some of the objective nationalist works. And the main feature of that work, I think, is the solo parts, with the clarinet and the horn parts especially demanding. Our young artist did very well. I think you'll all agree if you heard that concert. Anyway, Taubman was not impressed with the variations. He acknowledged that although Ginastera gave the instruments of the orchestra individual air to breathe, he nonetheless felt that the atmosphere created for them is so full of cloying perfume that one is quickly surfeited. Continuing in this vein, he observed, the Argentine composer is glib and slick. He knows a lot of the obvious tricks of the trade, but his opening theme is saccharine, and the variations are no improvement. Lang was even more blunt. Deeming Hinastera a musical sleight of hand man, he observed, "In Hinastera's case, an Argentinian dabbles in French Impressionism, but the picture was not clear to me. I could not decide whether the Pampas were transplanted to the Place Vendôme or vice versa. Therefore, I had to settle for the Café de la Paix," which, as everyone knows, is sort of a buffer state. He's referring to two landmarks in Paris. Mr. Hinastera is clever, but he forgets one important thing. When one operates with clichés, it is most dangerous to be cute. And he was insufferably cute. As if charges of slick operating, not to mention cuteness, were not enough, an aura of derivativeness hung over Hinastera. In February 1957, Dimitri Mitropoulos conducted Hinastera's Overture to the Criollo Faust, Overture to the Creole Faust. This is an objective nationalist work, and the overture was inspired by a poem by an Argentine poet, Fausto, that tells of a gaucho who ventures into the Argentine capital and chances to find himself at a performance of Gounod's opera, Faust, which he then describes to a friend in his rustic vocabulary. Hinastera realizes all of this musically. But according to the New York Times, Hinastera's overture, quote, suggested that the gaucho had spent more time listening to Copland's El Salón México than to Faust. Given this supposed proximity to Copland's most accessible Latin-tinged work, it comes as no surprise that New York first heard the concert suite Estancia, surely the equivalent work in Hinastera's catalog, in what amounted to a Pops concert. In July 1960, in Lewison Stadium, singer Eartha Kitt performed songs by Kurt Weill, Ellington, selections from West Side Story, and other miscellany such as Beat Out That Rhythm on the Drum from Carmen Jones. You know, all the arias from Carmen have been given English words. Beat out that rhythm on the drum. Okay, I won't sing for you anymore. Besides Estancia, conductor Maurice Levine offered Borodin's Polovetsian Dances of Reader's Digest 100 Most Beautiful Melodies fame, and Copland's An Outdoor Overture. Eric Salzman proposed in the New York Times that whereas an outdoor overture and Estancia, quote, might have seemed unlikely companions for such repertory, Kitt's fans were delighted with the unstuffy, lively, rhythmic music of a couple of classical moderns, end quote. Salzman further elaborated on Estancia in his review of the 1960 Everest recording, describing the work as, quote, a kind of a cross between Rodeo and Oklahoma. Elsewhere in the United States, critics followed Salzman in conferring Pops concert credentials on Hinastera. Although, to be sure, many thought more highly of his objective and subjective nationalism than their New York counterparts did. Although slow to arrive in New York, Estancia was warmly applauded at its U.S. premiere by the Indianapolis Symphony in Indianapolis under Fabian Savitsky in 1954. The indefatigable Henry Butler, who held forth in the Indianapolis Times not only on music, but on world affairs, the Kinsey Report, and the latest kitchen gadgets, was especially delighted with the accessibility of the final Malambo, commenting, quote, "It was Latin cacciatorian, the kind of thing you want to whistle on your way out." In 1955, Pampaiana No. 3, Harold Schoenberg's gorgeously orchestrated hunk of nothing, was deemed a travelogue by one of Louisville's critics, with another claiming that it, quote, had the earmarks of a real concert hit. Reviewing the first string quartet for the Los Angeles Times in January of 1956, Albert Goldberg suggested that, although the quartet was, quote, not profound, he allowed that it was, quote, stamped by a strong creative impulse. In short, until the late 50s, Hinastera was seen as a friendly enough, albeit conventional, southern neighbor. As for works from Hinastera's third period, the neo-expressionist period, in these, the composer incorporates serialism, microtones, tone clusters, aleatory, and other avant-garde procedures. Figuring prominently in his neo-expressionist oeuvre are the operas Don Rodrigo and Bomarzo, the violin concerto, and the first piano concerto, all from the 1960s. Yet Argentine elements can surface. Hinastera, a liberal Catholic, labeled the second movement of his 1963 violin concerto a transubstantiation of the triste genre, the vocal genre highly ornamented, sung by the gauchos, and which he had used to such effect in his objective nationalist period. In the United States, it was works such as these, true to the modernist aesthetic of the Cold War, but with a whiff of Argentinidad, that initially established Ginastera's reputation. How did he do it? As we've seen, Gilbert Chase anticipated Ginastera's ascent with his tripartite scheme. But Chase also introduced another theme into Ginastera reception, namely sublimation, or the idea that base instincts can be channeled to a higher social good. This idea, borrowed from chemistry, is also widely attributed to Freud, especially in the United States. Indeed, thanks to the ways in which Freud was understood in the United States, the main target of sublimation, the base instinct to be rechanneled, was invariably sex. And don't worry, this isn't going to be one of those sex papers. Freud, who regarded sublimation as but one of many psychoanalytical goals, was always amused by this, by the power his U.S. followers assigned sublimation. In a culture that believed sexual continence benefited society, however, sublimation could be an apt tool for controlling sexual behavior. Many in the burgeoning U.S. psychoanalytic community seized on sublimation to justify their moral codes, which they reinforced from, quote, dizzy puritanical heights, as one New York psychoanalyst complained. During the Cold War, as psychoanalysis peaked in popularity in the United States, the concept took on new life. Terms such as socially acceptable or of value to society increasingly came to dominate the psychoanalytic literature, as sublimation guided patients toward adjustment, as that desired state was called. Here, U.S. psychoanalysts found an unexpected ally in the mainstream clergy. Repulsed by Freud in the 1920s and 30s, churchmen now took advantage of sublimation, appropriating the concept to reinforce religious teachings. This newfound rapport was celebrated in May 1956, the Freud centenary year, when psychoanalysts, psychiatrists, and the clergy gathered at New York's Cathedral of St. John the Divine, an irony that would not have been lost on the atheist honoree. At the same time, analysis became a respectable middle-class activity during the Cold War, with terms such as complex, Freudian slip, and repression insinuating themselves into everyday American English, and later into episodes of Mad Men, while books such as Self-Confidence Through Self-Analysis and Be Glad You're Neurotic became available to a wide readership. When Time magazine featured Freud on its cover of 23 April 1956, it was clear that Freud had arrived in his U.S. Cold War era incarnation. The artistic community effectively embraced sublimation as well. As we've noted, artists privileged abstraction, aesthetic autonomy, and control. Also, much the way Freud's U.S. followers attached moral codes to sublimation, so too did a moral dimension adhere to artistic sublimation, one addressed, for example, by Pierre Bourdieu in his Distinction, A Social Critique of the Judgment of Taste, in which he describes the process by which the work of art became, quote, a test of ethical superiority, an indispensable measure of the capacity for sublimation. Likewise, Adorno, although no fan of Freud's artistic theory, nonetheless allowed that sublimation, when properly realized, enables the critic to distinguish art from, quote, cuisine and pornography. To cuisine and pornography, we can add musical nationalism. Like sex, nationalism is a drive. Through native instruments and folk dances and their unsubtle arousal of the body and the body politic, musical nationalism excites the lower impulses of the seething masses with their animal-like urges, which an elite that understands pure pleasure and the probity it affords will reject. As with other kinds of drives, nationalism can be repressed. But because a repressed drive cannot be sublimated, as Freud himself stated, a composer must work through his or her neurosis or heedless nationalism, sublimating the nationalist impulse to the higher goal of universalism with its lofty promise of disinterest. The best example I've found of these rhetorical strategies as applied to Latin American music is Chase's series of no fewer than three articles, all from 1957, and all about Ginastera. Chase noted Ginastera's readiness, quote, to move away from Argentine nationalism in the first string quartet, for example, in the theme of the variations, Variaciones Concertantes, and in the 12 American Preludes, since in each work, quote, the national element is sublimated rather than realistic or literal. Likewise, in the first piano sonata, quote, the spirit of the Malambo is sublimated to the nth degree, whereas for Chase, the second movement, quote, reaches heights of sublimation hitherto unattained by Ginastera or by any other Argentine composer. Ginastera's new status as a rehabilitated nationalist was most conspicuously celebrated through the Washington-based Inter-American Music Festivals, organized by Colombian conductor Guillermo Espinosa, which ran intermittently for some 20 years. Supported by various corporations, the festivals invariably included a program booklet, which opened with a greeting from the current U.S. president, who was the honorary festival chair and the president's wife. Here's one from 1973, signed by that great friend of Latin America, Richard M. Nixon. The festivals were a showcase for international modernism. Henry Cowell, whose Symphony No. 14 was performed in April 1961, commented in his program note, quote, Dodecaphonic internationalism eliminates everything that has been developed as a national style, end quote. Indeed, practically all festival composers rejected folkloric nationalism. A case in point is the concert during the fourth festival, to which Spain was invited. Composers took advantage of this opportunity to challenge the long-standing perception of Spain's presumed backwardness. Indeed, the concert of June of 1968, which had to be rescheduled because of the Poor People's March on Washington, featured not jotas or seguidillas, but objetos sonoros, sonorous objects, geometrías, geometries, and superficie número uno, surface number one, works of that same ilk. Surely, the terse headline of Alan M. Kriegsman's article in the Washington Post, Composers Drop Nationalism, best sums up the festival's orientation. In fact, it was Ginastera whose music effectively launched the festivals. In April 1958, his second string quartet was featured at the very first festival. Commissioned by the Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge Foundation, the work unfolds in a five-movement, fast-slow, scherzo, slow-fast, symmetrical structure that recalls Bartok's arch forms, as do some of the more rhapsodic passages in movement four. References to sonata form in the serialist first movement situate the quartet in the Western tradition, with pitches from the row furnishing fifth-based harmonies. Serialist procedures are most strictly observed in movement three, a scherzo with two trios. The row for the scherzo, trios one and two each use different rows, divides neatly into four trichords. The hushed fleet movement is also remarkable for its narrow dynamic range, within whose Webernian limits, Ginastera achieves a remarkable variety of instrumental colors through harmonics, glissandi, collegno, sul ponticello, and several varieties of pizzicato. Luckily, it is really a very quiet piece. Even in the face of all these modernist strategies, the cognoscenti heard sublimated nationalism in the 3-4-6-8 meter shifts in the first movement, which they likened to the Malambo. Caused a sensation. Erwin Loewings of the Washington Evening Star enthused that Had these inter-American music festivals done no more than focus the spotlight of public attention on Ginastera's brilliance, they would be memorable events in the annals of music. Most praiseworthy was Ginastera's modernist bent, manifested not only in his finesse with serialism, but in a quality Lowens described as, quote, controlled turbulence. Paul Hume, in turn, noted superb organization, especially in the outer two movements, which derived much of their urgency from a strongly dissonant system. Even Taubman, who had taken such a dim view of Pampeana No. 3 and the Variaciones Concertantes, was persuaded. As he declared, the quartet, quote, bespoke the seriousness and professionalism of the composer for its original and exciting synthesis of contemporary trends. Moreover, in his rhythmic ideas, Señor Ginastera refers to the idiom of Argentina, but otherwise his quartet reflects not a local landscape, but personal vistas. In other words, Ginastera was moved not by provincialism, to borrow Chase's term, but by the dictates of individual inspiration. The once glib and slick composer had arrived. Now Ginastera's career in the United States took on new life. The second festival featured his first piano concerto and the freely serialist Cantata para America Mágica, the Cantata for Magic America, which was commissioned by the Koussevitzky and Fromm Foundations, respectively. Although the cantata's 58 percussion instruments and indigenous texts might have prompted references to a primitive other, Hume applauded profound intellect and superbly calculated equilibrium. Lowens, hearing incredible complexity in the cantata, which he called the, quote, logical culmination of Ginastera's evolution from militant nationalist to citizen of the Western Hemisphere, attributed this shift to Ginastera's abandoning of, quote, the Gauchesco nationalism of earlier years. In 1965, the third Inter-American Festival featured Ginastera's Sinfonía de Don Rodrigo for dramatic soprano and orchestra. The same year, the music advisory panel of the State Department's cultural presentations recommended Ginastera's music for the Juilliard Quartet's tour of the Soviet Union. Suddenly, New York was friendlier to Ginastera. His violin concerto premiered there in October 1963 by Ruggiero Ricci and the New York Philharmonic under Bernstein, and it was applauded as, quote, one of the most exceptional works to come out of South America. Ginastera's greatest triumph in the city that had once snubbed him, however, was his opera Don Rodrigo, which inaugurated the New York State Theater at Lincoln Center in February 1966, with Plácido Domingo heading its enormous cast. Critics considered Don Rodrigo within a narrative of anti-nationalist high modernism. One enthused that Ginastera, quote, like so many others, left behind his own brand of nationalism to embrace current serial and aleatoric practices. Another, praising Ginastera's stringent dodecaphonic idiom, called Don Rodrigo a 12-tone Otello, recommending it, quote, to those who may have labored under the impression that whatever originates in South America is bound to be reactionary. Throughout this period, Ginastera's photograph circulated in the media, his thick black glasses and serious demeanor, all characteristic of the Cold Warrior. Cuteness now long behind him, Ginastera even came to be tagged by Donald Hanahan of the New York Times, a musical Robert McNamara, for his squareness of cut, the same reverence for duty, efficiency, and the middle way, alongside intellectual virtuosity and technical brilliance. And for those younger folks in the audience, Robert McNamara was the Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam period. Other critics took up this theme. One noted that during rehearsals of Ginastera's second opera, Bomarzo, a tale of sex and psychological violence, that the composer sat in the auditorium, quote, buttoned into his sober business suit, peering over big black-rimmed spectacles. Additionally, he was seen, quote, to speak of Bomarzo, again, this is a very violent tale, with the air of a mathematics professor elucidating an equation, always looking over his black-rimmed spectacles. What can we learn from this account of Ginastera's reception in the United States? At the height of the Good Neighbor period, when the Americas were united against European fascism, Copland gently chided Ginastera for undue susceptibility to European influence, commending instead Ginastera's finesse with folklore. Yet Ginastera's objective nationalism, which corresponded so aptly to official Pan-Americanist music, was nonetheless seen in the United States as derivative, or we might say middlebrow, to borrow another term from the Cold War era lexicon. Indeed, it was only when Ginastera rejected militant nationalism that he really became a respected citizen of the Western Hemisphere. Aiding him here, as articulated by Chase, was the narrative of sublimation, itself reflecting the Cold War era horizon of expectation. In short, Ginastera's story is one more example of the ways in which a given public will invariably attach its own values to works of art. In it, we also see, in microcosm, one more instance in which composers, scholars, and critics wrestle with nationalism. Who gets to decide which works are nationalist? As Aurelio de la Vega complained, such a privilege may depend more on political and economic power than on intrinsically musical qualities. The irony is, later in the Cold War, specifically in the 1970s and 80s, nationalism became a banner in Latin America, and U.S. scholars began to consider Latin American music almost solely through this lens, thus closing off any possibility for the achievement of true universality that Chase so prized. As I initially noted, scholars, too, began considering Ginastera almost solely in these terms, effectively isolating the composer, such that by the end of the 20th century, many music lovers have either never heard of Ginastera or are familiar solely with Estancia, which is often performed on special concerts devoted solely to Latin American music and invariably recorded or advertised under the rubric Fiesta. Here's a CD from our library, which features Ginastera's Estancia, the tale of the windswept pampas. And if you come up and look at it later, you'll see that it has several couples passionately embracing one another in a good many sort of Caribbean-type shirts and palm trees in the background. Oh, rather incongruous. My talk this evening is part of this bigger story and the bigger question, what do we in the United States know about Latin American music, and how do we know it? I thank you for accompanying me this evening in exploring that question as we find out more and more ways to investigate it even further. Thanks very much. I'll be happy to take any questions you might have, or we can converse informally over the delicious reception that's over there in the corner. It's up to you. Yes.
I don't recall there being too much discussion of Latin American music when I was going through college many, many decades ago. Still in the middle of the Cold War, I'm just wondering if Cold War political attitudes had something to do with, perhaps it did, but in your opinion, it has something to do with this not being covered in the basic music history classes that I took as an undergraduate, for example. There really was very little exposure.
That's an excellent question, and it's certainly an accurate observation. If you look at the standard music history textbook, some of the students in my music history pedagogy class are here, and we've looked at some of the textbooks starting from the 1960s, and we see that Latin America nowadays, many, many decades later, is perhaps given, there are perhaps a few pieces, a few paragraphs. Certainly during the Good Neighbor period, this was not the case. The Pan-American Union, for which also employed Chase and it employed people like Charles Seeger and various other cultural diplomats, librarians, people who were interested in promoting the Good Neighbor policy, also undertook publishing short biographies of Latin American composers, Latin American scores by Latin American composers. In fact, our library here is unusual in that we have a great many of those publications from the Pan-American Union from the 1940s. Those continued into the 50s, into the 60s, but because of the increasing tension between Latin America and the United States, it was obviously much more difficult to bring off the idea of hemispheric harmony. I mentioned Vice President Nixon's trip to Latin America, it was a total disaster. I mean, at one point his car was overturned, and there was so much anti-U.S. sentiment that to have preached the good neighborly gospel that was possible during the Roosevelt period really would have been very much out of place at that point. So I think that is part of the reason, and that's why I became so interested in studying the Good Neighbor period, because, as I also mentioned, that was a period in which Latin American art music was important in the United States in a way that hasn't been equaled since that time. And it was a very brief period. Is everybody hungry? Well, thank you again.